Group meeting, Friday, 15th July, 1977.
Philistry, when a difficult circumstance arises, and it is seen, and it is felt, very often, although it is seen and felt for what it is, there is still a good deal of pain, discomfort or worry still present, which is hard to get rid of, hard to allow to die away. Is this a question that, although one is trying to keep one's mind quiet, there is still clinging that is retaining this?
It is an extremely interesting phenomenon, this pain and so on which is associated with what rises up in the mind. Actually, there is greater insight into oneself, productive of really worthwhile self-knowledge, if one looks at this pain and suffering far more intently than looking for the answer to the problem or the question. Why should a question cause me pain and suffering? Ordinarily, if there is no pain and suffering present, the question is asked because one naturally likes to acquire knowledge, or its intellectual curiosity, or whatever it may be. But if there is no pain and suffering attached to it, then you may find that the question or the problem, if any, is a superficial one and not deeply interrelated with the living of the religious life. Insofar as one does live the religious life successfully, it has become a natural thing, a matter of course. So there is no question which arises in relation to that in particular. Now, when pain and suffering arises, it means that here is a question, here is a problem which has its roots deep in the confusion in our minds, our state of fear, uncertainty, a sense of having done wrong, and so on. All this is involved. And if one looks very carefully, intensely, and it is very difficult to do so under these circumstances, if one looks very carefully and intensely at the origins of this pain and suffering, or with the specific points related to it, namely, are they greed, avarice, jealousy, fear, possessiveness, etc., etc., you see, then one learns about oneself a great deal. One sees that these are the things that are troubling me. the person who's free of fear of violence, of delusion, of enmity and so forth, person who is free of those things does not experience that sort of pain and suffering. There can be considerable intellectual uncertainty, distress with respect to the nature of facts, to the facts themselves, intellectual distress which is related to the question, what is the truth? You see, because when one lives the religious life in the real sense, one knows that what one regarded as truth and obtained a sort of an inner satisfaction and poise, saying to oneself, this is true, I know this is true, and all's well. As the years go by, you discover that it is not so very true. What one believed was true when one was 10 years old becomes a different belief at 20, still different at 30, still different at 50 and 60. And the person thinks, good gracious me, I do not know what the truth is. I've been deluding myself. See, because what one sensed and felt as truth undergoes change. That sensing and that feeling and that belief must necessarily undergo change. And therefore it teaches us this tremendous lesson that we have been grasping at a formulation of reality instead of being really in touch with reality. If we are really in touch with reality, actually in touch, then every formulation, and it is the brain which formulates it, you see, must necessarily undergo change, till there may come a time when there is no need for further formulation. Then the pain and suffering and everything just vanishes altogether. You see, this is the point. We are grasping. We want, then we naturally ask, why do we grasp? Because we want security. We want to be happy thereby. If I know the truth, I shall be happy. This is a profound error. Very often the discovery of the truth, as we call it, the facts, cause great distress. You see, it's like that. So when this business of pain and suffering in association with any problem or question comes up, look more into your own inner state, and as you understand that and see it and see how it functions, you will find that the question which you asked will probably change its form altogether and may disappear altogether. The question just vanishes.
Actually see the problem, you know, one looks for what is, because if one sort of tries to formulate it, it's already, you can't get near it, or you look for causes in past, and so how could one just get to the point to just seeing it?
consider what is the meaning of the word problem, and consider why and how does any question arise at all. A question arises because perhaps in the first instance the fact is, well, I just don't know. You see? Now, if it is a matter of simple facts, the question will be there, will be easy to formulate. But because we do not know all that is associated with the facts, we find it difficult to formulate the question clearly. You know, it is a well-known fact that if one can ask the question rightly, then the answer is there, hidden in it. Now, consider the other aspect. It's becoming a problem. A problem affects us individually quite strongly. You see? Now what lies at the root of a question becoming a problem or a situation becoming a problem? First and foremost, that's not merely first and foremost, it's the whole thing. One has not understood. One has not seen clearly the situation as a whole. This is very important. Admittedly, it's not easy to see its importance or to understand it at all. It means that one's own mind is in a state of confusion in relation to that particular situation. And one's own mind is in a state of confusion because one's own mind is so subject to one's greeds and ambitions and fears and all the rest of it, and illusions, and particularly fixed beliefs and convictions and mistaken ideas all along the line, and one is not ready to let them go. So this question becomes a problem, something which seriously affects us. Our own minds are in a state of confusion. Now, you will ask, well, how do I tackle that? Look quietly as possible at the thought process associated with the problem, with the disturbance of the mind. Look at the thought process. Don't try to stop it. Don't try to get rid of it. Don't seek a remedy for it. Do nothing about it apart from looking at it very, very intensely and as completely as you can. And if possible, free of reactions from the brain. You see? Then, when the brain becomes a little bit quieter, it becomes a proper instrument of observation. And when it becomes a proper instrument of observation, you will be able to see the forces at play. Are they fear, ignorance, delusion, etc., you see, which have brought about this state? There is no other way that I know of, anyway. To fight against it, to want to be rid of it, is a mistake. Because this is what teaches us. If you want to be rid of what teaches us, then how can you live the religious life? Or do the right thing, to put it in simple terms. You can't do the right thing because you don't want to see the facts of the matter. If you are prepared to see the facts as the facts, in their fullness and so on, you really want to see the facts, then you will find that emotional upsets and intellectual entanglements will gradually subside. And you will see clearly, the brain will be quiet and the unconfused mind will be at work and know the truth of the matter. See, I am distinguishing between the brain and the mind. I always use the word mind in the sense of that totality which is the one and only mind of the whole universe. The brain is what the individual human being has as the instrument through which mind can function freely. All our troubles and confusions lie in our own brains. They affect the psyche. Each person has his own particular psyche, but nobody in the world has a mind of his own. We loosely use that phrase, my mind, or I have a mind of my own. It is very inconvenient to talk in those terms. It's much more convenient to distinguish psyche and mind. See, just as your body is your body, isn't it? Your own body, exactly your own body. There is no other body like it. It's perfectly distinct, it is yours. Now, since your body is matter, made up of matter, which comes out of universal matter, doesn't it? It's the same chemicals which, and so on, which compose the matter of the universe, which are patterned as your body, which is unique to you. In the same way, this thing, this energy, which we may call universal mind, it is an energy, just like matter is energy. You see, this universal mind interacting with your body produces, is manifested as your particular psyche. And so that reflects and contains within itself all those processes which we call our mental processes and our mental life. So it's very convenient to define psyche this way and leave the word mind to express that universal energy which produces your psyche by functioning through your particular material pattern, your body. So if you look at it that way, then you will find that the brain, which is material stuff, as it gets quiet, will enable this universal energy, which is pure and complete and absolute, it has no problems whatsoever, will function freely through you. And the brain, the psyche, they will all become quiet, and your problems, your confusions and so on will disappear. There will be light. It's very hard to see this. Don't believe it simply because I'm saying it or anybody else says it and so forth. Try and sort of understand it in depth. When you understand it in depth, you will feel it with your whole psychophysical being, and you will see it, formulate it conceptually and verbally, also with your whole psychophysical being, not merely with a part which you call your intellect. There is no such separate thing called your intellect. These are all words which represent the the being as a whole, the psychophysical being. But we have to use analytical separating words to talk at all, otherwise we can't.
Now, when you see the thought process, this would say we would look at the thought process in certain categories, ignorance, illusion, and so on. Yes.
You see, the words which we use to categorize the thought process simply means that what the word means is paramount for the time being in your whole psychical process. The psyche functions as a whole. Everything is there simultaneously, always, all the time. But something comes out prominently. You see, it's predominant. So we say, this is illusion or delusion. This is fear. And it is associated with bodily electrochemical processes, and particularly with chemical reactions, the secretions which are thrown into the blood, and so forth and so forth. So you see, all of it functions as a whole, but the brain becomes aware of it specifically as this, that, or the other, because this, what the brain says, is the paramount functioning at that moment and during those moments. Well, this is something which is a wonderful thing, which is very fascinating. Every psychophysical organism functions totally all the time as a whole, but the brain is not aware of the thing as a whole all the time. And as a matter of fact, this is one of nature's safeguards for us, because if the brain received all the impressions that come into us without filtering and sort of putting aside so many impressions as just so much buzz which is not required, we would just burst with the influx of all these impressions upon us. The organism couldn't stand it. So the nature has made the organism in such a way that this selective and filtering process, as the scientists call it, goes on and presents to the brain just so much which the brain can't stand. Can't take it in otherwise. You see? You were going to ask something?
Well, I just on that last point, you say that the brain is a sort of filtering process. In other words, it sort of filters out a good part of totality, would you say? From that point of view, then, and it's a purely conceptual idea, but would you say that an experience of samadhi or something is in fact the absence of the filtering factor of the brain when totality rushes in without that? Or is this just purely a mad concept of my own?
You see, samadhi, which is the supreme state of awareness being that a human organism can experience, can realize, is of a totally different nature from specific impressions and thoughts, feelings, and so forth. These specific impressions are the conceptual, verbal formulations by the psyche. Every one of them is a finite and limited something. And it comes, it affects the individual in terms of finite particulars. So you can get a heap of them, you see. And it is here that this selecting and filtering process comes into play. How does one enter into samadhi? This is the question we must look at. When the impressions that come to the organism are not prevented, not resisted, nor grasped at, or desired, then oneself has become empty. You see, oneself has become transparent, offering no obstruction to the free passage of all these things. So, this, what you call the rushing in of totality, is not like the whole universe coming at you and trying to sort of make lodgment in you. No such thing takes place. You see? It is a new dimension of being and consciousness, which is not yours, but is functioning through that non-resisting organism. This is what people forget. And people think, therefore, that when one enters samadhi, then how does one experience it? The word experience has to be used, otherwise we can't talk at all. Actually, samadhi is never experienced. It is there. You see? And it is there with an immensity, a totality, which is an infinitude, an immeasurable something. There you are, I use the word something. It is immeasurable, it is not a something. It is absolute, it is not relative. Totality functions freely through a non-obstructing you. So it doesn't rush at you. You are in that totality is in you. Just like we talk of an object in space. And we talk like that because we separate matter from space and time. But they are all there in actual fact, they are all there simultaneously. But because the brain and the psyche are limited and they are finite and they grasp and hold on to this, that and the other, they offer a resistance to the functioning of totality through you. And because of that, there is a disturbance. But when one really lives the religious life, one is a real yogi in the supreme sense of the word, then this obstruction has disappeared altogether. This obstructiveness having disappeared, there is no question of knowing that you are in samadhi, or learning something in samadhi, or becoming wise, or transcendentally loving, or anything in samadhi. All these are ways of talking which misrepresent samadhi. You see? In connection with what we have been just considering, note how it is so difficult for anyone to be free of this attitude, this desire, to become perfect, to be liberated, to fulfill one's destiny, to enter the kingdom of heaven, or to reach nirvana. Now all these terms, these words, represent something very finite and particular. Our whole ordinary life experience is in terms of attaining this, acquiring that, achieving this, progressing thus, and so forth and so forth. Look at each and every one of them. They are all finite. They are limited. They are always changing. They are mortal. There is the reality of transcendence. But not one of these words or phrases or aspirations or anything represents in reality, because it cannot represent reality in terms of infinitude, immortality, and so forth. And yet, those who have been touched by transcendence know the reality of this dimension of being and consciousness, which goes utterly beyond all our finitude. You see? When we talk, therefore, of becoming the perfected Holy One, I use that phrase myself over and over again because there is no option but to use these words when one is talking. Or one tries to reach nirvana or enter the kingdom of heaven and so forth. One is actually talking, and the whole psychophysical being is functioning in terms of the mortal, the measurable, the thing which is of illusion, and so on and so on. You see? Therefore, we are always thinking and talking in the wrong terms in relation to this transcendence. And we are so bound by our everyday experience in this realm of mortality and suffering and so on, that we just don't know that we are talking nonsense in relation to it. For instance, I have used this phrase, set your sights on transcendence. But the whole phrase, set your sights, is a limited, particular, finite act. How can you use that in relation to the infinite, the immeasurable, the unknown by the brain, unknowable by the brain, the non-formulated, the unimaginable? See, you can't do it. And yet, our whole ordinary, everyday psychophysical life is such that it completely imprisons us in this darkness of conceptual thought and verbal formulation. And yet, the extraordinary thing is that there is no other instrument available but conceptual thought and verbal formulation in order to communicate either with other people or within ourselves. But if we just once, even once, get touched with this immensity of transcendence, and that it is completely other than all this, and yet permeates all this is subsumed and sustained in that, you see. If we once get that, then this very process of conceptual thinking and verbally formulating through being awake and sensitive to the fact that we mustn't grasp this, that this is all changing, that this is all just hot air, you see, vapor, just useless vapors, but they are necessary in the ordinary everyday process in the everyday world. And we let go, and this mysterious this extraordinary mystery suddenly comes to life in its fullness. Now, if the psychophysical organism has been properly prepared, it does not get shattered when it happens. This is the reason why all the great spiritual teachers, the founders of the religions, and all the true spiritual teachers emphasized again and again purity, morality, the purity of the whole psychophysical being. Because if the psychophysical being is pure to start with, well, not necessarily, but in the whole process of realization, if the psychophysical being is pure, then it will not be shattered when that condition of revelation, continuous revelation, takes lodgment in the psychophysical being. Takes lodgment not in static terms, not as a thing which has come there, but as a no-thing which functions freely through what appears to be the thing, the person. That's why they emphasized the moralities. I mean, look at all the teachings of the great teachers. What did they talk about? Don't murder, don't steal, etc., etc., etc. That's all. That is the fundamental thing they taught. What is the basis of the whole discipline of yoga? The moralities, the religious observance, and the disciplining of the body through the postures and the breathing, so that it will not be an obstruction to that infinitude when the deep states of consciousness and the dormant powers of the mind are released into actual manifestation. Because don't forget, just as nature has its protection for the psychophysical organism by preventing all the impressions that come upon us from being presented to consciousness, but a process of selection and rejection and filtering goes on and presents just that much to consciousness which the organism can stand. Just as there is that process, so too there is a process of protection which goes on with respect to all the great archetypal modes of expression of transcendent energy from completely shattering us. You know, scientists have discovered in recent centuries the different layers in the atmosphere which save the body from being annihilated if all those radiations from outer space were to come in and barge upon us. We'd just be wiped out. But we are not. We are protected by these layers, you see. And these are material things. I'm just using the word material for convenience. These are material things for our protection here. So too, in the psyche and outside the psyche, there is this protective influence at play of the tremendous archetypal forms which the one transcendent energy takes in manifesting itself throughout the universal process. We are quite ignorant of these archetypal energies at play. There are simple things, though, we may notice, and everyone notices. Sometimes, under certain circumstances, this particular individual feels absolutely marvelous. The whole atmosphere is just heavenly and divine and so forth. And his next door neighbor, the man next to him walking along the street, is in a state of turmoil. But they are both being contained within that same atmosphere. I'm just using the word atmosphere. That same, those same influences are at play upon these different individuals. The different individuals react differently because their own psychophysical being is of a different pattern, which will respond in different ways to the play of these archetypal energies. And yet, on the whole, there is a protective influence. Now, the supreme protective influence is one's own purity. What has the pure man to fear or suffer from when the great archetypal forms of transcendent energy, which we call transcendent love and wisdom and beauty and goodness and all the rest of it, play upon our being? What has the pure man to fear from that? Nothing at all. It is because we are not pure, in the strict sense of the word, in the true sense of the word, the full sense of the word, that we react adversely. And so there is a protective element at play, particularly through our unawareness of these energies.
This does raise a number of very sort of fundamental issues, it does set me in a tizzy. And I must confess that I don't really like what you say, if you're honest.
Good. That's splendid.
For the simple reason that one can understand moralities and the social necessities and so on, but to put a concept of purity upon as a prerequisite for the influx, again I'm using the word in a very loosely, of transcendence, if you were, as though it was a dangerous substance, does make it very, very difficult to sort of accept. One understands it is fundamental to certain yogic practices that in fact there must be purification before the kundalini can be raised, for instance. That sort of thing, but as a concept of purity, to put to separate oneself from something else, which is a concept of purity, and to try and live up to an ideal, is in itself a continuation of the duality, which prevents the influx, again in inverted commas, of transcendence. Because whilst you have the concept of purity as something outside yourself, as something of an ideal outside yourself, there is that division, there is that duality. And therefore, whilst that's happening, there cannot be the non-duality, which I understand is the essence of transcendence. To live the religious life, which I assume is the non-grasping life, is a non-grasping, of course, would then entail, presumably, it would naturally follow that there would be, I suppose, a purification, if you like, because you aren't grasping food and drink and sex and various other things. This naturally follows. But to set it apart as something to be achieved makes it a very, very, very difficult thing, I think, for, say certainly for me personally, to accept, because we are back to the old puritanical school, you know, which are from my own personal conditioning, one has tried to go through. And therefore, what I'm trying to say is, purity itself is a concept, and therefore it is limited. While it is limited, we are in the field of duality, and whilst in the field of duality, that is the self, the barrier to transcendence, just as any other concept would be.
Again, our difficulty is with the word. Every word of that sort, purity, etc., involves a concept. Otherwise, the word is a meaningless sound altogether, and we can't deal with it or utilize it, and it cannot affect us. It's just meaningless. How it's a case of putting it in such a form that one sees what is implied. Would the word healthiness or wholeness be a more useful word?
Well, personally, no, because it's any ideal of that sort is the separation.
Is it like refining gold, where you don't add anything to the gold to purify or refine it? It's just how you just burn up the impurities. Is it not something like that? You don't add anything to the gold at all. You don't put purity into it.
Well, I think that's probably a very good analogy, really, because it's a question perhaps of taking away, and if you're taking away, although you have a concept of taking away as well, it's something which is shed as well. You can't, you do say very frequently, you can't spread cleanliness into a room, as it were.
Transmuted rather than shed, sure.
Well, now,
all I was just going to say is this is the essential question. Where you do have any sort of concept like that, it bespeaks action, motivated action. And motivated action is action which is grasping. Grasping, therefore, is not the religious life, in inverted commas.
Well, supposing we approach the situation this way. As one exercises mindfulness, one observes, let us say that something has happened which causes great upheaval, fear, anger. The two may go together. Now, through the mindfulness, the fear and the anger disappears. That psychical state which we named fear and anger has changed into calm and freedom from fear, freedom from anger. Now, if we are talking about it in terms of the pure state and the impure state, which would we denominate the pure state and which would we denominate the impure state? Or, if you don't like the words pure and impure, which is the state which is suitable for living religiously, which is conducive to living religiously?
I wouldn't know, and I don't think it's a state which is knowable.
Does that mean that one wouldn't know that one is going through fear, that one is frightened, that one is angry on the one hand, and that one is not afraid and not angry on the other hand?
Well, I mean, one has the concept of the all-compassionate Buddha, if you like, someone who can receive every manifestation of change with perfect equanimity.
Ah, yes.
That is a concept, and it's a separative thing. Until one is there, one wouldn't know. And this is what bugs me a little bit. You know, obviously, one has got to use words. One has got to have concepts about the religious life. You know. But how do you know how to ride a bicycle until you've actually done it? It seems to be that sort of thing.
All right. Take the case of riding a bicycle. Whilst one cannot ride a bicycle and falls off it, etc., one is unskilled in relation to riding a bicycle. One is incapable of riding it. Wherever I practice, which would be a sort of correspondent to mindfulness where the psyche is concerned, by practice you become capable. So you've got again the state where you're capable, the state where you're incapable, and you know both states. Because in the one case you have a toss and you can't fail to register that, and in the other case you ride along comfortably and you can't fail to register that. You know this, I do appreciate the reaction of people on this question of purity, the use of the word purity, and associating it with puritanical. Just as one may talk of being right and being righteous, being right in terms of thought and feeling and conduct, physical action and so forth. And there is a reaction against righteousness, this righteous person, you see. But just how much validity has this reaction against the word puritanical and against the word righteous? It's a wonderful opportunity to look within ourselves and find out, why do I rebel against the word purity? What is impure in relation to the word purity?
Does purity differ from nirvana? Do they not have the same implication?
Of course they have the same implication. Nirvana is nirvana. This duality of purity and impurity comes into being because we have particular norms to fit into particular limited contexts and situations. But if we understand the whole lot, really understand it, we ourselves have become truly pure and therefore are able to be the compassionate Buddha, the wise Buddha, the understanding Buddha.
Shouldn't purity be transcended?
And when you transcend purity, what is there?
When you have transcended purity, I should have thought you are in the whatever, you know, I can't use the words, in nirvana, in the absolute, and in freedom.
You see, with every word that one uses, apart from words which have no particular meaning, nirvana, God, etc., have no particular meaning. They are outside the realm of particularity. All these other words are in the realm of particularity. But if you use words at all, if you have a thought at all about it, it is bound to be in the limited state. There are no words in any language which can specifically represent that which is transcendent, that which is infinite, that which is immeasurable. So, people have naturally used the words which stand for what are commonly called the virtues as against the vices. The compassionateness of a Buddha. If you are against the word, you can just as well use the word the uncompassionateness of the Buddha, to use the same thing, to represent the same thing. But you see, we have to realize this. But we do know as a simple fact that to commit murder, highway robbery, etc., 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 is something which you discard, even in terms of ordinary social decent living, leave alone religious living. You discard all that, don't you? You don't condone it, or do you? You don't support it. Well,
shall we have time?
Yes, Sophia.
Some time ago, you have spoken about karma, and your special view is so, it was so interesting. I would like you to remind the karma and possibility of effacing it, and how.
You know, that is really an immense subject, and to deal with it effectively, we must start a meeting with considering this question of karma, its meaning and applications and so forth. But there again, in order to understand it, the brain has to be pure. If it is cluttered up with fixed ideas and fixed concepts, you see, karma means retribution, karma means this, that, or the other, That is the impure mind. The word impurity there simply means that, nothing else. It hasn't got a kind of a very narrow moralistic connotation. Take the most matter-of-fact concrete situation. Don't we wash and cleanse the body? Why? And is the washed and cleansed body, and the healthy body, is that a pure body or is it an impure body? I mean, we have to be sensible in this matter. Just use our common sense here. We use words and we must use them effectively and in each particular context.
It seems to me, though, that these impurities take on certain disguises.
Of course they do.
Which are related to karma. They are sort of, through the retribution, they are more and more unrecognizable.
Look, don't talk about karma in this connection.
No.
Because otherwise we'll...
But they get more and more unrecognizable, don't they?
Unrecognizable.
Yeah.
Well, that is an excellent thing, because as it gets more and more unrecognizable, as the brain becomes more and more disturbed and confused, this is a wonderful opportunity to look into ourselves and discover what is there in ourselves which produces this state of imbalance, which this state of confusion, of distress, turmoil. Why are we in turmoil? You see? And it is not enough just to make a cold-blooded intellectual analysis of it. That is not enough. That is ineffective, because all we have done is to project out of ourselves and put at a distance that which is the impurity in us, which makes this unfit to be the living vehicle of transcendence. Transcendence means that the duals which compose a duality are both so fully understood that which the duals represent, the psychical state, the psychical nature which the duals represent, is completely transmuted into an absolute good. What we commonly call good and evil, what we commonly call love, hate, cruelty, kindness, if we completely understand any one of those duals and see how the other dual is involved in this dual, you see, then an extraordinary thing happens inside the psyche. There is a complete transmutation of that psychical energy in us which manifests as this or that dual, and our ordinary ambivalent functionings psychically is completely transformed. This distinction between the unconscious or subconscious mind and the conscious mind and all that disappears, and there is only the whole, the unified mind, which is the mature mind, the healthy mind. Of course, when we talk, all these words, mature, healthy, have their opposites. But the transcending of them, we have to use some word, and throughout the ages, the teachers have always utilized the word which in the ordinary dualistic state stands for a virtue rather than a vice. This is the difference. I think we'll have to stop there today. We've already had over an hour.